Tonight on Arena, Night Bitch rumours and On Becoming a Guinea Fowl are the movies up for review, and bringing Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge from the screen to the stage. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and we are available to view on rte.ie/arena. Tonight's film reviews The Primal Instincts of Motherhood, Intergenerational Trauma and Gothic Horror at the G7. In Night Bitch, the always intriguing Amy Adams plays Mother, a woman whose maternal instincts are evolving into something altogether more feral. On Becoming a Guinea Fowl depicts a family in conflict after a controversial relative dies. And in Rumours, the leaders of the free world face off against the undead in this horror satire starring Cate Blanchett as a very familiar female German Chancellor. Tara Brady and Dave Hanratty have been to the pictures for us. They're with me in studio this evening. And we'll start with Night Bitch, adapted from Rachel Yoder's novel of the same name. Amy Adams plays a woman who has left behind a promising career in art in order to raise her son, as her former identity becomes subsumed into the demands of motherhood. Unusual animalistic traits seem to be emerging. And up until that last phrase, really, did I say that Tara Brady and Dave Hanratty? I did. Up until that last phrase, unusual animalistic traits seem to be emerging. The idea that somebody's identity becomes subsumed in motherhood is hardly new territory for film, for fiction, for anything.
No, it's definitely not. But I think, like Yoder's book, and one of the things, like the, which is sort of works and sometimes doesn't, or sometimes also works against the film, is that it preserves kind of big chunks of the book, and it has this kind of inner monologue, and it has this idea, well, I should be feeling on top of the world, and I should be feeling magical, and I get to be a stay-at-home mom, and it should be this wonderful magical time, and I'm not really feeling it. And there's a lot of moments all the way through the film where you're looking at stuff like that, and you're going, you know, especially if you're someone who's had experience of being at home with a toddler and trying to keep toddler entertained, you go, well, I've thought that, and yeah, I've done that. So there's a very, you know, there's a hugely relatable element all the way through the film. I think one of the issues, though, with the film is that it's this great idea, which is this idea that, like, that you're stuck in this rut, so there becomes this outlet where you're turning into a dog. But that always feels like an adjunct, I think, to the story. It never really feels like it's a story about metamorphosis or transformation. It always feels like this is this literary metaphor that hasn't really worked out.
And
you have a couple of scenes early on. You've got that great scene where there's a sort of a pustule, shall we say, that she's dealing with where her tailbone is, and then it's like the film sort of forgets about that, that aspect of it altogether.
And the title of the film, Night Bitch, when I saw this first, I thought, are they referring to the way this mother is behaving at night? But of course it is a canine reference within this. Tara's touching on it there, Dave, the canine aspect of it. Does it get lost? Is it well realised?
It is forgotten about, yeah, because it almost comes to be her alter ego, her superhero alter ego at some point, or maybe her supervillain alter ego. And you kind of wonder what they're going to do with it, because they're presenting you with that edgy title and it's going to provoke conversation. That's the plan. But the problem with this film is, and I did like it quite a bit though, but I will say the problem is that it's kind of stuck between stations. It can't quite commit to a singular idea. And that, I guess, whether it's magical realism, is it happening? Is it all in her head? Is this what happens when someone is so exhausted they have to conjure up this other personality that in this case happens to be a human transforming into a dog? You know, is this all just a metaphor? Is it all allegory? It's an interesting thing to throw into your film, but it is that. It's thrown into the film. And like the film forgets about it for 10, 20 minutes at a time, comes back to it on occasion, never really, really confronts it. And you have at the centre of this an incredible performance from Amy Adams. Now, you would expect that going in. She's a fabulous actress. I mean, I think it's a crime to this day that she wasn't even nominated for a rival, let alone win the damn thing. But when it comes to her performance here, she's giving you so, so much. And the script, I think, keeps holding her back. Because even, like, you know, to say it to a friend, this is a film about a woman who thinks she's turning into a dog. it sounds like a Scandinavian film or something. It sounds like a comedy of manners or an extreme horror. And in the end, it's not really any of those
things. None of the above. Let's listen to a clip where the aforementioned Amy Adams, simply referred to as Mother throughout the whole film, shares her theory of feminine power with her friends, including Liz, played by Orkana Rajan here, who has just announced that she is expecting again. And strong language a couple of times within this clip.
I can't believe I'm going to go through this all again. Birth.
That's so fucking intense.
How do you think Daniel will do?
He always tells the story of my first birth and how the doctor turned around and said, it's time to get that baby out. And there was a vein popping on my forehead. I was like a wild animal.
Yeah, wild animal.
Oh my God, yes. My husband said the same thing. That the sounds coming out of me were pure animal. He almost passed out. I mean, he's not good with blood, but...
Oh, yeah. Hi. Do you ever feel like the big secret is that we are gods?
What?
We fucking create life. We make life. We are so powerful. I bet men are terrified of us. I mean, look at you. You are this miraculous goddess growing bones as we speak.
I am pretty powerful.
Amy Adams and Orkana Rajan there in a scene from Night Bitch. I was saying as we were listening to that clip, you get a sense that there are some great ideas within it, even in that in that short clip. Scoot McNairy plays the husband here. Are there any fathers as stupid as Scoot McNairy's character?
I believe
21st century anywhere.
I believe there probably are, but he really does take the biscuit. There's a couple of really great scenes where there's a scene where it's his turn to bath the toddler, and he ends up calling her in for this and for that, and every time she sits down, she's called up. And there's a couple of really well observed scenes like that, where the division of labor is not all that it should be. And then of course he has this corporate job, so he keeps disappearing off in a car and you don't see him again for days, and which isolates her even further. But you know, there are really good things like that. There's also like that scene where she goes to meet her college graduate chums and she's so out of it, and again it's this sense of isolation. Like, she can't talk to her husband and she certainly can't talk to them. They're all, you know, continuing on with their lives in the art world, and her jokes now are toddler references, and it's almost like it's somewhere between horror and cringe comedy. So there are really good moments like that, but I just don't think it congeals into a proper movie shape. I think it's one of those books. It was a hot book that it was optioned before it ever hit the shelves, and it feels like they've been too reverential to it all the way through.
It sounds like it is that the fundamental problem ultimately, Dave, the old page to the screen difficulty.
It's also the fact that they don't really feel like real people, and that's obviously intentional. You can hear it in that clip as well, and the colleagues that Tara mentions that she has dinner with are all these ridiculous caricatures. You know, they're meant to be hardcore pretentious, and you're meant to kind of turn your nose up at them as they would at you. But I think it has little victories in it. I think it's nicely confrontational at times, and it is kind of holding up the question of, like, let's be honest, guys, being a parent can actually drive you crazy. And like, I think that that's a good thing to kind of put on the screen. But when I say it has little victories, it's because it's contained in this kind of small, hermetically sealed world. And even the Scoot McNairy character, like, he's a great actor. I love to see him, although I do prefer to see him pop up in roles with a bit more heft than this. It just, the fact that it kept stopping to kind of explain the movie to you, like, there is a great scene in the restaurant where she does kind of have a big emotional monologue. It reminded me of Mads Mikkelsen in Another Round when he gets depressed on his 40th birthday. But at the same time, it was the film screaming its theme at you. So
and a big monologue sounds like it was lifted off the page of the novel rather than worked into a screenplay. Stars from you, Dave?
3. When it works, it works, but it doesn't work enough.
And what are you saying? Tara?
I love Mariel Heller as a director, but I think she's probably too nice for this and there's not enough anger in it. And yeah, none of it quite fires a three as well.
A three from you. Let's move on then to On Becoming a Guineafowl from Zambian Welsh director Rungano Nyoni. It tells the story of what happens when an extended family's reaction to the sudden death of an uncle becomes mired in dark memories of the past. As they are recalled with chilling effect. Tell me about the image at the very start of this film of the character Shula, played by Suzanne Chardy.
Well, the image at the beginning very much sets this, because she stops in the middle of the road and there is the body of her dead uncle, and we come to learn that he's there in very inappropriate circumstances because he's near to the local brothel.
And where are we, by the way?
She's returning to Zambia after she's an emigre. We learn that she's been away for some time, so she's got a little bit of distance from these, which adds to the kind of absurdity of a lot of the rituals and the things that we see throughout the film. She stopped out in the road. The uncle's there. She has this very like sardonic, matter of fact phone call home to explain that she's seeing this body, and then she gets out of the car and she's wearing Missy Elliott's costume from the Rain video, and that's very much kind of the tone of the film. It has all these kind of visual like punchlines, yeah, all the way through. Which is really unusual, because the film is ultimately about someone who is we learn is an absolute predator. He's a pedophile and he's a serial rapist, and yet all the way through Nyong'o mines this incredible dark humour from it.
And within all of that, Dave, it sounds as if Suzanne or Susan Chardy, the character Shula, is she very different from everybody else in the family? Does she stand out in her wearing of costumes, or are the family equally odd?
The family are definitely odd and a lot more boisterous than she is. I mean, the costume that she wears at the beginning is kind of as science fiction as she gets. I mean, it's clear that she's become quite westernized. You get these little glimpses, like she throws on a podcast that's clearly like, I think it's The Diary of a CEO or something. And I'd say she's outgrown her family, which is something that we can all relate to. I mean, this film is obviously set in a very different part of the world, and you know, you wonder if you can connect to it from this part of the world. But there was actually a lot of universal truths in this, and I thought that her distance from the family and the social kind of awkwardness that happens, especially when you bring people together and they have to collide after, say, something like a funeral, the death of a loved one, and as Tara points out, this loved one comes with an awful lot of teeth and baggage, as we learn over the course of the film, and is clearly responsible for inflicting generational trauma upon people, perhaps even including early characters. So she's quite reserved. Like, she says a lot with a little. It's a fantastic performance from Susan Chardy, saying so much with just her eyes. But like, there was times when I watched it and I kind of was like, oh, I want her to be a bit more vocal. But the more I get away from the film and the more I kind of think about the internalization of what she's trying to project, it's quite masterful. It's a small film, but it's huge at the same time. It's a small cast of characters. They're all, you know, broadly different in terms of their collisions with each other. And it feels like she's trapped. I mean, like, this feels closer to a horror film than anything else, even though it's not necessarily trying to be.
And the generational difference here, obviously the uncle, there are members of the family who are of that, of his generation, and then there are the next generation down who may have been, who have suffered at the hands of this, what sounds like pretty ogreous type of character. How different are the two generations?
They're very different. But there's also divisions even within generations themselves. Because we know that there are other, like, she has her own peers within her family who are also willing to talk about things that Uncle Fred did, and it becomes very clear that this is widespread. And we realise as well that the kind of older matriarchy in the family are kind of propping this up, and there's a real attitude of let's not talk about that, or we dealt with that, or that's over. But there's a very, very strong attitude of let's not speak ill of the dead, and you end up with these incredibly absurd sequences, like where they have to call out this absolutely laudatory, you know, memorial pamphlet over the phone, like talking about how great Uncle Fred is when we know the things that he's done. And, you know, and then worst of all, we meet this like bride that he has, this wife that he has, and she has children by him, and she's virtually a child herself, and when we meet her, she's chastised royally by the family because, you know, why is he dead? Why wasn't she looking after him?
It's your fault.
So there's just this incredible tension within the family.
And within all of that, even some of the things that Tara's describing there in terms of the way families deal with things, this could be a family, I'm guessing, almost anywhere, even though we are in Zambia. And it certainly sounds like it could be an Irish funeral.
This is the thing. I mean, like, it brought me back to my own father's funeral a couple of years ago. And I was thinking how, like, on these occasions, there are people who will make themselves the main character of this, who may not, you know, it might not be their purpose to turn around and kind of, you know, throw that level of grief upon other people and kind of make it about themselves. But that's what happens at funerals. Like we can't necessarily present the best versions of ourselves. And we do kind of, some people revert to a childlike state. Some people take charge. People have rows. Do they unfold the way that they quote unquote should? And the fact that this is from a much different part of the world, but like I said, I mentioned that phrase, universal truths. Like, that's what really grabbed me, apart from some of the incredibly transfixing imagery here. I was watching this and I was like, I've experienced things like this. I've stood in those rooms with those people, and I found myself not being heard and becoming frustrated on this. And why is that person over there celebrating that person? Or why is that person doing this? So that is something that you can absolutely project yourself upon. Like, the humanity of this is incredibly real. It almost feels documentary style at times, which, like, it has a lot going for. Like, there is that dark comedy as well. It's a potent mix. And I think in the hands of a different filmmaker, it would just completely collapse. But actually, it does weave together.
Yeah, and Nisi clearly does the job here. Stars from you on this one, Dave?
I think it's a 4. Like, I've been thinking about it since I've seen it. It's a tough watch, even though it's a small film, because it's a glacial pace. The details are granular, and you are kind of hanging in those moments with these people, and that can be a tough thing to be in. But I keep thinking about it. I think it's really, really impressive. So 4 stars.
4 stars. And even though it is that glacial pace, I think it's 99, just under 100 minutes. So it's not exactly the longest film in the world. Does it hold for that, and does it work for you, Tara?
Oh, yeah, definitely. By 4.5, I think it's a very, very strong film. Like, it stays with you as well. It's a film that you like her first film, I Am Not a Witch, like, you dream about it afterwards.
Well, there you go. That sounds like, don't know if it's quite Christmas fair, but it might be one to, one to think about for early in the new year when you're looking at your credit card bill, perhaps. Let us move on then to final film this evening. Rumours, Guy Maddin's horror satire on geoglobal politics. I'll get there eventually, starring Kate Blanchett as a strangely familiar and brightly jacketed Chancellor of Germany. At one level, this I was kind of excited about. Then I heard some bits of it. I haven't seen the whole film, but I heard some bits of it and I thought, are they really doing those accents? What's actually going on here? What is the setup, first of all, Dave?
The setup is an exaggerated summit. The G7 summit that we should all know, you know, the world leaders of Germany, Canada, the USA, the UK and Italy and Japan and so on. They come together. They're played by actors such as Cate Blanchett and Denis Menochet and Charles Dance. And they're broad cartoons. Like, these are very exaggerated versions of our real life equivalents. Cate Blanchett, as you indicate, is clearly modeled on Angela Merkel, although she looks more like a cross between Princess Diana and I don't know, maybe she does look like Angela Merkel the more I think of it. But it's all played for laughs, and they find themselves at this summit, and their one job is to come together and write this rousing speech to unite the world. And wouldn't you know it, while they're at their gazebo and downing wine and barely doing any work, everyone just disappears around them, and these strange mud people come along. And are they zombies? Is this happening at all? Are we in an apocalypse? I will say I was terrified about this, because I looked at the premise and I just thought of that film Don't Look Up from a few years ago, which I think is maybe the worst film to be released in the last 3 or 4 years. And honestly, people involved in the film should be in prison right now. It's so bad. But this, thankfully, isn't as bad as that.
You're not sending them behind bars just yet.
Not just yet. But okay. It is broad. It's a farce. It's a satire. Whatever. What have you.
Let's have a listen to a clip. They're contemplating leaving the so-called safe environs of the gazebo here. But what awaits outside? Let's have a listen.
We had to flee the gazebo. We were attacked by dark, shadowy figures.
Protesters.
That's what I thought too at first. But they didn't have signs. They didn't chant any slogans. And if they objected to any specifics in our program, they didn't say so.
I believe they were protesters, if a little unconventional.
They were not protesters.
What then? The press, spies, goblins?
Shh, this is serious, Maxi.
What were they then? Terrorists?
Something less than terrorists. And something more.
But you say that they attacked you.
Well, attacked. They loomed, threatening me.
Vendramino was quite aggressive, quite hostile.
Very grumpy.
They were grumpy? No, they were violent, more than grumpy.
Very grumpy. Scary.
But they were people. Yeah? Who? Human beings.
Yeah, the voice of Kate Blanchett just at the end of that as the Chancellor of Germany. And in the midst of all of that, because I refer to the accents because they are, you know, straight out of a comic book, the type of accents that are given here. Yet Charles Dance plays Edison Woolcott, the President of the United States, with a very British accent.
Yeah, this is a joke that tickled Guy Madden and his Canadian co-writers. So to make sure that they cast the most British person they could find to be. It actually works as a joke, but I can't explain to you why they went along with it. But then, you know, Guy Madden is a man who's made films like Saddest Music in the World, in which Isabella Rossellini is an amputee with glass legs filled with beer. So, you know, he loves his surreal moments. And, you know, this film has a giant brain and it has the masturbating zombie people, and it has an awful lot going on in it. But like at heart, like it's a kind of very old school B movie, but it does have certain things to say. And like I really like the sort of the way he captures the kind of nonsense that politicians speak. And
because
like
the G7, let's face it, is kind of ripe for satire.
I like that they, you know, when they're in the middle of, like, in the thick of things, and you get statements like, "We are here to produce a provisional draft of the statement regarding the present crisis," and you know, and it's like it's very, very good and thing. And I love the fact that, you know, sort of you get this visual of Denis Menuchet, who's a very, very robust actor, and he's so useless that he ends up losing the use of his legs and being wheeled around in a wheelbarrow for most of the film, and then of course, being from a Canadian director, it's the Canadian the Lothario with a man bun who steps up at the end, and all that stuff is very funny. It's a very, very silly movie, and like when I saw it at a midnight screening, and I think that's what it should be seen as, is like a very late night screening in a big packed theatre. It's that kind of, it's designed to appeal to kind of a Rocky Horror Picture crowd or a Little Shop of Horrors.
With my thoughts that there might be some serious political satire going on here and quite edgy looks at what is happening in the free world, I can forget about that, Dave.
Yeah, it's not very incisive at all, really. I was with it for a bit. Well, the first act is promising, and it's set up very, very well, and they're all very good in their roles. The Canadian guy in particular, played by Roy Dupuis, he almost steals the movie. Like, he's really, really good. The performances are strong, but my two big problems with this film is, number one, I don't know who it's for. Like, I really don't know who this is for, apart from a very faux intellectual crowd who read The Guardian every week. And I'm a faux intellectual who reads The Guardian, but I didn't find it very funny. And that's my problem number two. The script just isn't sharp enough. It's the same joke over and over again. These people aren't good in a crisis. Do you get it? Yeah, I do. Is there anything else? No. Alicia Vikander shows up at one point. I don't know what she was doing. Like, I admire the hustle and I admire getting this cast together, because fair play, like, it's a hell of a cast. But I just don't think the material is strong enough. I just don't think the jokes are there.
Is there anything to recommend it then outside of, you're saying if we in 5 years' time or 6 years' time, we'll all be at late night shows wearing whatever outfit suits us?
No, well, I saw it first at Cannes, and I like that everyone roared with laughter all the way through. So it does work in a crowd, I think. I think if it's a film, if you're watching it by yourself or in an underpopulated cinema, it might be a bit miserable, all right. But I think if you're there with a crowd, I think it's very good fun.
Stars from you then for Rumours.
Three and a half.
Are there any protesters? Are the protesters zombies, and what's that saying?
The film doesn't quite know, nor does it quite resolve it. A lot is left to be ambiguous, which is fine.
Yeah.
I love a bit of abstract, but again, it just felt like holes in the script. Okay. It's two for me, and maybe it's because I was in an underpopulated cinema at 10 in the morning. I mean, like maybe I should go to a midnight screening and I'll see the truth of this film.
Yeah. Midnight screening with lots of other people. It can be hard enough to find that
I
one.
Can.
My thanks to Tara Brady and Dave Hanratty. Rumours goes on general release from tomorrow. Night Bitch and On Becoming a Guinea Fowl will open in selected cinemas also from tomorrow. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Welcome to the Moulin Rouge. Moulin Rouge, the film, is what we call a jukebox musical. Set in fin de siècle Paris, it is the story of the Scottish poet Christian and his love for the star of the Moulin Rouge, Satine. The film was co-written and directed and produced by Baz Luhrmann and starred Nicole Kidman as Satine and Ewan McGregor as Christian. But it was the staging of the Moulin Rouge, the legendary Paris hotspot, and the use of popular music in the soundtrack that set Moulin Rouge apart. The film was released in 2001, some 8 years later. My next guest secured the rights from Baz Luhrmann and Catherine Martin to make it into a stage show. That show, the stage version of Moulin Rouge, is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in November of next year. Delighted to be joined on the line by the woman and producer who convinced Baz Luhrmann and Catherine Martin to give her not only the rights to Moulin Rouge, but also to Strictly Ballroom, Luhrmann's 1992 film. An investment which was repaid with full houses, rave reviews and 10 Tony Awards. Carmen Pavlovich of Global Creatures, you're very welcome to Arena, Carmen. First of all, can I clarify that in the case of the stage show, I will still be crying at the heartbreak of Christian and Satine, and that essential central story of the poet who falls for the showgirl is still there?
Yes, of course it is. Lovely to be with you, Sean, today. Yeah, I mean, we had to think and talk a lot about what it would mean to translate the film to the stage. And we knew we needed to keep the iconic moments and not disappoint fans, but at the same time, let it have its own life and make sure that, you know, that we were bringing something new to the experience. But that idea of Christian kind of entering the underworld is so central to the story, and the idea of impossible love, that we did really want to make sure we preserve that incredible love story and moved audiences as much as entertained them.
I guess the fact that it's the setting here is a stage show. Satine is a stage girl. Christian is a poet, but he's writing this script for her to act out on stage so that they can get the money from the investors. I guess translating that to a stage setting, I'm not suggesting that it's easy, but at least you're in the right spot.
Especially when they talk about the corporate blood-sucking vampires that are producers. Yes. yeah, I mean, the story is the story we know from the film, but slightly, you know, modified in places. We really wanted to sort of ground the show, and, you know, theatre, it just, you sit in the scenes for longer with the audience, and we wanted to also update it for today. And so the music is probably one of the biggest shifts we've made. We definitely have kept all of the iconic songs from the film, and, you know, the songs the fans love and would expect to see. But a lot of years have passed since the film, and we knew that we had the opportunity to update some of the catalogue with songs that have happened since the film. So, you know, I'd say it's probably about 50% of the music that was in the film, and, you know, another 50% of updated music as well. But essentially all the things people know and love about Moulin Rouge they'll see, and some, yeah.
Now, you talked about corporate blood-sucking vampires that producers are. Talking about yourself as a producer is quite complimentary to yourself, really, aren't you?
It's a line from the show when they're convincing the Duke. They're convincing the Duke to invest and put on their show, and they say it's for everybody, for family, and they reference corporate blood-sucking vampires. It always makes me laugh, actually, still every time I see it.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the corporate blood-sucking vampire went into the meeting with Baz Luhrmann and Catherine Martin, because I believe it was a lunchtime meeting that you went to along with your business partner to secure these rights, as I say, not just for Moulin Rouge, but for Strictly Ballroom as well.
Yeah, it was a really memorable lunch, actually. I always remember it because it was springtime in Australia, and I just always remember this kind of smell of jasmine in the air and lovely sunny day, and we sat out on their balcony and had lunch and talked a lot, and it was really a meeting of the minds very quickly. You know, we both ran companies that really loved our Australian heritage but just had a desire to play on a world stage. And so we really connected on that idea and just loved the idea of really, you know, I guess keeping some sort of Australian presence in the, like, you know, I guess the ownership and the creative teams, and still having the opportunity, though, to take these stories around the world. So it was a pretty immediate meeting of the minds. I think that was September from memory, and by December we kind of had our deal done and were chinking a glass of champagne in celebration to each other. Yeah. And so we went from there. But Strictly Ballroom we did first, and Baz directed that. Mm. And excuse me, the rights for Moulin Rouge are just extremely complicated, and there was just a lot more to piece together. And it took us really 10 years to put those rights together and produce the show, which I could never have imagined at the time. But, you know, there's the Fox is the film studio hold rights, and then the Moulin Rouge in Paris control the title. And then, you know, we've got 75 songs in the show that represents the work of 160 composers, so all of those needed to be cleared as well. So it's quite an undertaking.
Yeah, and I think have you added some new things from the film? Have you updated it from the film? You've put in more contemporary music into it as well, I think. Do you change that as you go along, or would that be an absolute nightmare looking for new rights all along, all the time?
We don't actually. I mean, we kind of always thought, oh, wow, this show's got the opportunity too. But we just really love what's there, and it works. And there's, you know, a lot of kind of thinking and making these songs fit dramatically in the show as well. But I think it's just like a nonstop kind of, we talk about deluxe maximalism a lot in the show, and it's just nonstop. The music just keeps coming, and it's lovely watching the audience kind of respond to different music moments they recognize and know. And it's a lot of fun, a lot of Easter eggs in there. But as I said, we connected pretty early and pretty quickly with Baz and Catherine, and they really gave the team the blessing to make it their own, and were there kind of as supporters the whole way through. And I think we've really tried to honour the work they created, which really was an honour to have the opportunity to do that, but also make them proud by bringing something new. And Baz says himself that he was a young rebel when he made those films, and he's not a young rebel anymore, and he wanted to see the work in the hands of the next generation who would sort of bring a different life to it.
Well, let's listen to one of the pieces of contemporary music that is certainly in there, and I'm sure we'll have people singing, possibly dancing in the aisles of the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre when it comes here, and potentially had it doing them just that on Broadway. There you go, a little taste of Lady Gaga and Bad Romance, one of the songs that features in the stage version of Moulin Rouge. And speaking with me this evening is Carmen Pavlovich. I wondered, Carmen Pavlovich, producer of the show, to what extent did you choose songs that had to fit into the story itself, or just songs that you guys liked and wanted to hear on stage?
Oh, no, for sure the songs had to have a dramatic imperative to them, so... it was really important that the songs, really the lyrics, have to be able to function as if they were dialogue. Mm. So a song like, there always had to be.
A song like Bad Romance, then, I presume, is referring to some of the aspects of the Duke and his bad doings in the story.
Yes, well, I mean, that number really is kind of talking about impossible love and... all the kind of backstage intrigue. But, you know, that's also a big production number, so we have a bit more license there. And that really was such a fantastic collaboration between every member of the creative team to kind of bring that song to life. So it's definitely one of the kind of defining moments of the show, and I think one of the things that really sets it apart from the film.
And will this be your first visit to Ireland when you do come here, Carmen?
No, I've been to Dublin before. Do you know, my grandparents were from Clare County. My mother's maiden name was O'Connor. So I have a bit of Irish heritage.
I didn't know there were any Pavloviches in...
I love Dublin.
I didn't think there were any Pavloviches in Clare, so I'm glad to hear it's the O'Connor side of the family. We might finish up, Carmen, by listening to, for me, one of the most romantic songs in Moulin Rouge, in the film version at any rate, Come What May. This is, again, this is again, I suppose, the impossibility of love, and how love can live on forever, I guess, is what's at play here.
Yeah, Yes, indeed. It's a beloved song.
And will be part of the show when it comes here.
It will indeed, yes. I think the fans would kill us if it wasn't.
I would think so too. Carmen, thanks for being with us this evening. And we'll finish up by listening to Come What May from the film Moulin Rouge. Oh, not a dry eye in the house, come what may. Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman from Moulin Rouge, the film. Moulin Rouge, the stage show, opens at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin this time next year, the 8th of November 2025. Can you believe we're talking about that already? It runs until the 11th of January 2026, but we're talking about it tonight because booking has now opened at moulinrougemusical.com. You can find out details there, or indeed on the Bord Gáis Energy website, boardgoshenergy.ie. This Saturday night, Dave Fanning returns to our TV screens with Series 5 of Fanning at Whelan's, a mix of chat and performances from emerging and established musicians, everyone from Wicklow R&B artist Kosha to David Gray. Delighted that Dave is with me in studio this evening. 8 weeks, Dave, of late night music ahead of us to bring us into January. You're still getting a buzz, clearly, from this whole idea of going out there.
The buzz is showing on my face. I went to 2 gigs this week. In fact, one of them, I have to say, wasn't even an Irish band. It was for the 7th time I went to see the Australian Pink Floyd. That's very sad. But there were 2 Irish bands I've seen the last week, too. Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course you do. Like, there's nothing. I'm going to tell you, I'll give you a perfect example. I went to the Sphere, right? And people, oh, you went to the Sphere, right? The first 2 nights. Yeah. Tell me about it. Like, is that the future of live gigs? Don't be ridiculous. The future of live gigs is standing in a pub hoping your pint doesn't fall as you're jostled because the band is right in front of you. That's what the future is.
And when you're out there and doing that and managing to hold on to the pint without spilling it, are there still as many exciting new acts bubbling up as there were when you started back in Old God's time?
The thing about Ireland, like, it punches above its weight. No, it doesn't. Like, there's at least 100 great bands in Texas that you haven't heard every single year. And I don't hear half them either. There's loads of great bands everywhere. Yes, we are a great country for music, but there's plenty of really great bands out there. The problem is, or great acts, the problem is it's not as easy as it used to be. Spotify don't get you anything at all. It's not worth it on any level. And there's no kind of contracts from record companies anymore or anything like that. You know, once Steve Jobs held up that sort of iPod in 2005 and then got the iTunes there, put the two together, record companies went. I know there's a few out there, but they're not really signing anything.
And
therefore, they don't underwrite.
And gigging is really difficult.
Gigging is really difficult. I mean, it really is difficult. Like, COVID was why we started this. We had to do something. So Whelan's, Guinness, myself got together and said, let's do something. At least we can do this. The money, it comes from Guinness. It all goes into the production for the band, like 9 cameras, best sound, best everything else, best lights, the works, and then it's up to the bands after that. And if they're not good enough, it's not my fault.
Yeah, you give them their platform. Yeah. Off you go.
And we're up to about 85 bands now, 85 access. By the way, when I say bands are a lot more difficult to find than a lot of solo singers these
days. Again, I suppose that's an economic consideration.
It's a real economic, because one of the bands I saw there last week have just come back from a tour of Ireland. They're a 6-piece band. How they can do it and go to bed and breakfast or hotels, whatever it is, and the petrol and everything else,
the cost,
it's really expensive. Yeah.
All right. It's not all new acts, however, and David Gray is there, and he headlines the first episode.
Well, one of the things about it is it's Whelan's, and David Gray started in Whelan's, as far as we're all concerned, because White Ladder did it in Whelan's.
Let's have a listen to him singing A Century Ends.
This is what he does. Yeah, because it's 30 years since that. It ain't the prettiest position as a century.
That's a little flavour of David Gray and A Century Ends, who is in this new series of Fanning at Whelan's because he started in Whelan's back in the day. Dave Fanning with me in Shoot the Scene. I was asking about the Bruce. I heard a touch of the Bruce Springsteen in his vocals in particular.
People have
there.
Said that in the past. I mean, maybe more so. Like, that's now, you know, even though the song he's singing is the first album, at least, because, you know, that's where he's going back to from the very beginning, you know, A Century Ends.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Amble. This is an interesting little group. Tell us a little bit about
it. Well, there's the two three-piece bands on the programme are the two biggest three-piece bands around, even though, like, you know, they're only, like, when they're selling out things like Three Nights at the Olympia and that kind of thing. Yeah. In fact, I saw them at Electric Picnic where they sold out the big tent. Like, it was really, well, you know, you can't sell out a tent because once you're in, you're in. But, like, it was packed.
Yeah.
And there are three guys from kind of the Midlands and the West of Ireland. And then you also get the other three guys who are Kingfisher, who are also different. And both those bands are on the programme. Yeah, Amble are very interesting. All right, yeah. Yeah.
How would you describe what they're doing? Because the folky thing is kind of very strong at the moment.
See, you really
got to
watch. If you start putting bands into pigeonholes, they'll be texting in a minute saying,
we're not folk, we're not that.
But they are. They are that and more. And like the guys who realised, you know, that they could really do pretty well as they were teaching and all that, you know.
Primary school teacher, secondary school teacher.
Together.
And a data analyst, is it?
Yeah, I think there's a data analyst there, all right. Yeah. Yeah. They're the ones who are contributing to the fact that there are less teachers around now because they just gave it all up.
Well, let's have a listen to Amble and a track called Lonely Island.
The mountains are taller than ever before. I know it's not an island for one.
That's Lonely Island from Amble, one of the bands that will feature on Fanning at Whelan's live. Well, they performed live
they
at Whelan's
live.
And then it's been broadcast this coming Saturday evening, 10 p.m. Dave Fanning with me in studio this evening. I was saying as we were listening that they can play and he can sing.
Yeah and I just got to start for it, but you led me into that because you said he's easy on the eye as well. he's looking good, you know.
Well, there you go. So he'll be televisual as well as everything else. I'm wondering about the acoustic nature of that. Is that economics at play again? Because you've
touched on there's a question. I mean, people would say, is it that acoustic is economics or solo is economics and solo is economics? No, not necessarily. I mean, like, if you're a three-piece band, you're a three-piece band.
Yeah,
and off you go and do
expenses,
the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we have, like, three acts in the first section of the programme, three acts in the last section, and then somebody comes in and talks about their favourite music in the middle. And the first one is Guy Garvey on Saturday from Elbow.
Yeah, who is the... can he do any wrong in this country, I ask myself. He's a big fan of Fontaine's DC.
Yeah, he picks them.
Yeah?
That's one of the ones he picks. Yeah, the funny thing about it is, yeah, he's kind of a bit of a national treasure in Britain these days. You know he's married to Diana Rigg's daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's a really nice guy.
And he had a child, I think, in the last couple of years.
He's always been a nice guy, you know. And he comes across as, you know, honest to God, you know.
Yeah, and it's there even in his music as well.
Yeah.
Does he perform or does he just chat with you?
He's just chatting. But the thing is that he Graham chatting, is there? No, there isn't. No, I'll tell you. Do you know a funny thing about him is that, like when he's playing or when he's talking, he's just, you can't not just love the guy. He's just one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. He really is
very warm. Yeah. Also, Ekosha's in episode one, isn't she? Or is she further into the?
Yes, I should know this, shouldn't I? Off the top of my head, you probably have a better list in front of you than I do.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you've probably got some of these recorded in the last one, so you might remember exactly which episode they. But tell us a little bit about her, because I love the song that you have that she's performing.
Well, she does two. Well, she does one in one program and one in another program. Yeah, and she was brought up in County Wicklow, but she wasn't from there. You know, she's
We'll find out which particular programme, hopefully, as we listen to this set. No Kink in the Wire is the one that we're going to listen to.
Yeah, that's one of the ones she does, yeah.
That's No Kink in the Wire from Kosha, who features in two of the episodes of the upcoming Fanning at Whelan's. Dave Fanning with me in studio this evening. We're just talking about the smoothness of her voice there. And that was performed. I know they get time to rehearse and all that. Yeah. But all the overlaying and the pedalling that's going on there all happens...
While she's standing
on the stage.
Like, while we're talking about all this and everything else, you forget there are rock bands on it too, though. You know? like Sick Lover there, Big Sleep there, Animo Drive there, and like there's a noise coming off them. Like, there is noise on the programme.
And you still like the bit of noise then, Dave? Is that still
I'll tell you, like an awful lot more noise. I think there's a little bit too little noise out there. We need more. We need bands who make noise. We need like Fontaine's on the next two nights at Three Arena, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and isn't it amazing that they're selling? So the bands can still rise to the top and play those big venues. That can
happen. Yeah, they can rise to the top and play the venues and do all that kind of thing. But it doesn't, like, I mean, they're headlining altogether now next summer as well in Waterford. Mm. But there's not enough bands out there, I don't think. And like the UK singles charts will show you that, that between 80 and 84, there was 144 at number one in the UK singles chart bands. In 90 to 94, it was 141. No, it was 143. And do you know how many bands have been at number one in the UK singles charts in this 5 years?
One number and then you're finished.
Okay, three.
Three.
Yeah. And in fact, one of them is Little Mix, which isn't a band. One of them is The Beatles, which isn't really around
at all. I said one word and then you're finished. Three.
Mad.
Thanks for coming in, Dave. That's Dave Fanning. And Fanning at Whelan's begins on Virgin Media 2 this Saturday night, 7th of December, 10 p.m. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.